Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.
I'm KC.
And I'm Tyler.
And you're listening to
The Element Podcast.
Welcome to the Element Podcast, y'all, brought to you by First Light Gear. I'm KC.
I'm Tyler.
And this is the second part of the Rut Q&A podcast. The rut's an interesting topic for a lot of people, man. People like to hunt whitetail deer, and they like to hunt big bucks, and those things come out during the rut.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a real good time to be in the woods.
Yeah.
It seems.
Seems so, like it.
Is that what you're looking up right there?
Yeah.
Gente de Bosque.
Yeah.
How about that? The Bosque River in Central Texas.
Bienvenidos, gente del Bosque.
That's it. The hunters of the woods. Let's go.
Let's.
Yeah. So we've been partaking in the Mexican food today, as per the norm, and discussing some things. We're going to answer your rut questions here in a bit. But first, we wanted to cover some talk, some things, some concepts, some ideas around consistent weather. You know, we just talked about cold fronts, and there's going to be a huge cold front. Probably has already happened if you're listening to this podcast, or it is currently happening. We had this discussion yesterday, actually, of like, what is the cold front? Is there a middle? Is there's a before and an after, but also is there like in the front? And what did you decide, Tyler?
About what?
Well, we were trying to discuss if there was anything besides a before and the after.
I thought we were trying to decide if the front is, if pre-front is before the actual front hits.
Yeah.
Or if pre-front, no, what was it? It was something weird where we were, the guy asked a question about hunting when the front comes in, or pre-front or post-front if we preferred it, right?
Yeah, and I think we're trying to decide, is there a middle time or is pre-front any time before the temperature starts to drop?
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to determine. Either way.
I mean, to me, pre means before.
That means like it's 85 and it's still 85.
Yeah.
It hasn't dropped to 45.
There's pre-front, there's post-front, and then there's
windy.
Dia de los front.
Well, right now we're talking post-front. That's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
We're talking about consistent weather, ideally.
At what point does it become pre-front, though?
Well,
at what point does post-front become pre-front?
It's a full circle. Every time it's pre-front, it's also post-front because there has been a front in the past. But prefrontal cortex, I think, is what they call that.
That's it, yeah.
So what we're going to look at here in the early stages of the rut this month is going to be some consistent and good weather around the country. Like, I guess you could always want it colder. It's hard to get too cold for the deer in the rut. But, like, what?
Oh, high head over there peeking up.
Michael's really excited about being cold.
He's from Ohio, which is Canada South.
Nights when there's a frost and days whenever it's like 50, like that's pretty solid. You're going to see a lot of that in the country. I think it's hard to give like actual temperatures, but just relative to average, it seems that the first week of November is going to be a little lower than normal, and that's good. I can remember, though, you and I hunted like a November 1 or 2. Oh. One time that was 0 degrees.
Yeah. Yep. I remember that, too.
That was bad.
It was bad, dude. That was back in the old gorilla suit days,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, I feel like that's a morning that you and I both had good hunts.
Yeah, we did. I had there was a couple days in there, but I know like the last day I had bucks fighting for like, I think they were fighting for like an hour on and off.
And that was post-front, like normal conditions. Or yeah. What were we calling like
very still. It was post-front, so probably like a soft east wind or something like that, mm-hmm. You know, like a light and variable pretty much.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was good. I think you might have seen that big 9 that you passed.
I didn't know it was a pass.
Okay. I don't know either. I was just making a joke. But
I didn't take the shot. I'll put it that way. It was back, you know, it was back in my conservative days, I think. You know, now I'm fleeing.
Now you're libertarian.
That's right. those, you bring up a good point. Those kind of days actually make for really good morning hunts, mm-hmm. I feel like. Those high-pressure, cold days, like a lot of times that makes for some really good action on the AM. And not that you can't hunt the evenings, but it's kind of like the first point in the year when, like, all white tail hunters can agree, hey, it's good to hunt a morning. You know, because there's a lot of guys. I'm not really one of them, but I understand the point that there's a lot of guys that are like, man, it's really not worth hunting mornings in October. And I kind of get it to an extent, also at the same time, I'm not going to sit at home when I could be hunting. I can go do something, maybe not mess it up, but
sight in a rifle or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
it's those make for really good hunts, and a lot of times they're still, so you can like do some calling
mm-hmm.
and chum up some action that way.
I think that them being still is a reason that the deer move pretty well because mm-hmm. they can hear, mm-hmm. you know, like there's not everything isn't just rustling around them and moving and the landscape is calm and still, and they can look out over across that field and see something moving over there and know that it's not a bush, it's a deer or it's a coyote or whatever
mm-hmm.
And also at the same time can hear, you know, and mm-hmm. that makes it like, dude, when you let off with the rattling horns on a day like that, it's like it carries forever. Dude. Yeah.
I did that 2018, maybe. Is that what it was? Whenever we rattled in that buck from forever away, and I missed him because it hit a piece of grass.
Yep.
That was probably November 2nd, 3rd, 4th, something like that.
I think
that.
It was like the 5th or 8th or something.
It was pretty – it was the first – well, it wasn't their first. No, that's right. It was a little later in the hunt. But, yeah, it was one of those cold, still mornings. And then last year – you killed on a consistent weather day in the evening. However, it wasn't cold.
No.
But it was still consistent.
Yep.
And that doesn't matter as much as temperature, but it also somewhat matters. Mm. Like if it's the first day it got to 85 after it'd been in the 60s, dead in the mm-hmm. woods. But if it's been getting to 85 every day for the past 4, 5, 6 days, deer have to exist and do things.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out for you last year.
Yeah.
When you went into that, did you have pretty good confidence?
Not necessarily. I had confidence that I would see some deer. I didn't have confidence that I would necessarily have a shooter. Mm-hmm. But that's because that property is like a very I can't just go shoot like the first buck that I think is big there. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? It's like my dad, it's a place that my dad hunts, and I guess you could call it managed. He wants to somewhat let bucks get to their potential. So
yeah, they at least
I'm not
go
shooting
for
a 3 or 4
class.
Year old, you know, yeah. most of the time. They're trying to shoot 5 plus year old deer,
mm-hmm.
and so those are hard to come by sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I had confidence that, and this is what I think my main kind of key point is when the weather's consistent during the rut. Is that I had confidence that I would probably see some bucks before before dark. And what gives me that confidence is that I think when the weather patterns are consistent, even if they're hot in the rut dates, so like say November 1st through 15th or so, you're going to have deer moving very similar to probably what their daily patterns are in say like the back half of October, mm-hmm. a lot of times I think. So, but the thing is, it's the rut. So there will be that once those deer get up in the evening, as it starts to cool off or whatever, the sun goes down, then the bucks like go mm-hmm. from that point. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I guess that last like window is where most of your movement's going to be, but it also is like, it's still better than October because mm-hmm. once they get up, they might walk a mile before dark. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's cooled off and it's the rut. So, mm-hmm. The thing that's good about cold fronts in the rut is that there's like all day movements, right? Or much more extended window of movement. So that's why those cold days to me are more fun, but you still have just, it's the rut. Like it's the best time of year and they're going to move more than any other time, even if it's 85.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I shot a big buck upstairs. It's a 2012 shot. It's got two split mm-hmm. G2s. I shot that deer on a morning, November morning, during the rut, and it was like 76 that day or something in November.
It's kind of wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was muggy, just a warm, warm
yeah.
morning.
You know, the deer that I shot on the ground in Kansas a couple years back was on a warmer morning. It wasn't freezing cold. I don't really remember what it was, but I had on just kind of like a light you know, hoodie or something. Mm-hmm. That's all I had on. Mm-hmm. You know, it was windy. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, they're going to be doing stuff with the does
yeah.
that time of year.
Yeah, there's a time of year, man, when it's there's a date range. Mm-hmm. Wherever you are, that it starts to really just be like they won't let weather patterns kind of overtake what they're wanting to do. Mm-hmm. It's just going to kind of put it in a smaller window of daylight usually, mm-hmm. I feel like. So
yeah, for sure. Oh, Eric is here as well. Eric of YouTube fame, Mr. just shooting all the does. I don't know if y'all have seen this, but Tyler shot a giant buck in Nebraska, and that was kind of like the icing on the cake that was Eric smoking some deer. Eric, how long did it take you to shoot two deer?
This was like 2 minutes, I think.
2 minutes. They're close together, man. It was awesome. And I actually enjoyed some breakfast sausage mm-hmm. that Eric had made from some of that. It was very delicious today. Eric is going to read us some Q&A questions. We're going to hop into that stuff unless you have something else you want to talk about. Anything else?
Nope. Let's get to these.
Hit us with the first
one. You got a bunch.
Dude, by the way.
Tell me.
Eric, if you follow us on Instagram, you might have seen, but Eric has told now the best doe story of all time.
The best does.
We talk about doe stories a lot here, and sometimes, you know,
everybody's got one.
Everybody's got one.
But now Eric has the best one.
They could be a little bit boring sometimes. Apparently, Eric's is the least boring doe story ever told.
How many views?
By the time people listen to this, it will be well over a half million. It's at a half million right now.
There's one comment that said, "I've seen better." So. Like, apparently there's better.
I don't know exactly what better he's talking about, but I don't know anybody who's killed two does and gotten a half a million views on it.
Golly, man.
Good job, Eric.
Efficient, thanks, man.
Way to go, man.
Dude,
you killed it on the footage.
Thanks, dude. Yeah. I've been waiting for somebody to tell me that.
All right, let's get to these. The first one, are bucks bedding near does in the rut?
I think it depends on the situation. I mean, if a buck, I have watched a buck actually bed with a doe right next to doe bedding in the rut. And so, but that was like a lockdown situation, right? Mm-hmm. So they're going to bed close to doe bedding because that buck's just going to go wherever the doe goes pretty much in that situation, at least. Sometimes they might force them to different areas or whatever. And then again, that there would still be bedding with a doe. But I think that like in the height of the rut, I think a lot of times bucks are bedding for short periods and just randomly wherever they kind of get tired real quick. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think there's a whole lot of rhyme or reason to bucks bedding during the like absolute just rage days of the rut.
I think you pretty much have to differentiate between the, are you referring to lockdown or a different time? Because a buck on lockdown is for sure bedded with a doe. He's like within 10 yards of her. If it's like, if he's just in the chasing phase, and I'm not saying that's like a date range, that's more just like what he's doing that day, because I've seen a lot of bucks locked down really early in the month in my life. So if that's what he's doing, then I'm going to say that no. If it's a single buck, he's not making where the does are bedded his consideration, because he's already checked those does. He knows if they are receptive or not. If they're receptive, he's probably up on them. If they're not receptive, he's probably going to find somewhere to take a rest for a second and then go find more does.
Okay, next question is, can you hunt near a gut pile?
Interesting. You know, there are people, there are old-timers that think that's a good idea. That I wonder if this person was referring to that, you know, kind of thinking about that. But apparently the smell of the rumen is supposed to attract deer. I don't believe it. I don't like it. I'll do it. But I think it's a real good way to have coyotes and stuff messing you up.
Ditto.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there, because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. Hey, if you guys like to cook outdoors, and you oughta, you should check out the Weber Slate Rust Resistant Griddle. Now, this is a good innovation here, and it solves a real problem, okay? So this is a carbon steel cooktop that's safe for metal tools, like a griddle on your grill. It's pre-seasoned with food-safe oils and ready to cook on right out of the box. There's no use of coatings, okay? You can use metal tools to flip, press, and scrape without worry. It's the griddle that stays ready, not rusty. Now, the problem with griddles, everything rusts. No one talks about how bad everything rusts. The reason they don't, because they couldn't fix it until now. Well, Weber's new rust-resistant technology, your Weber grill will last for years. When used, the carbon steel griddle hardens and bonds the surface, reducing the ability for moisture to collect and rust to form. With the new Weber Works Prep Cook and Store system, you can keep cooking and cleaning supplies handy, carry food and condiments from the kitchen to the griddle, and even convert the side table into a prep station. Get fired up for your new Weber Slate rust-resistant griddle. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
GPS/tracking services do you bring in the middle of nowhere?
I download a offline map for Onyx, and that's pretty much the way I do it. I mean, you go download, now they have it pretty cool where you can choose the resolution and the size. So like if you know you're just going to be like in 100 acres, you can download a real high res of that. Or if you know you're going to be covering half a state, you can download a medium or low of that half of the state. Or if you have the bandwidth, you can download a really high resolution of a ton of area. But that's pretty much exclusively what I use.
I have the what's the Garmin?
The thing for text messages?
Yeah, InReach.
Yeah,
that's what I use for like wilderness style hunting. For it's a satellite phone, so or a satellite GPS. You know, I don't use it for navigation. I use it for contacting the outer world. It's got a SOS button, and then for navigation, I'm using the downloaded Onyx maps, like Casey said.
Food plot or feed?
Well, right now, feed. Because
what's the difference?
There ain't much difference except one takes a lot more work than the other. Sometimes feed is real tough too, right, Tyler?
Yeah. Feed ain't working at all right now.
I mean tough to install.
Oh, feed? Yeah. It is. Yeah.
We spent quite a bit of time toting some corn bags in the long ways.
Guarantee
you. Yeah. Well, you're saying it's not working at all. I mean, right now, corn is not working anywhere we've got it pretty much. I mean, there's some deer around, but it's not consistent. And my food plot, until I just planted yesterday, was just dirt because we didn't get the right rains. So if you want something reliable, feed. If you want to be amateur ecologist, you can plant your food plots.
And I say, I don't mean to sound like I'm making fun of the question asker here when I say, what's the difference? I'm actually making fun of the people who think that when they plant these micro food plots, they're doing something better than feed.
Yeah.
So.
You should just do the thing that you think gives you the best chance to kill a deer.
Yeah.
I'm not a style points kind of guy.
No, I'm not either.
I like to do things a certain way, but it's just kind of the way I do it.
Yeah.
Just because of that.
To me, it's, I just don't like the elitist ideology of how your food plot is better than me also taking seed, which could be corn, right, and putting it on the ground. So that's just my thought. I know there's a billion different arguments for it, but I'm not a big fan of them.
What kind of cover do you see bucks bedding in most?
Thick. That thick cover.
Yeah. I think high stem count is like another way of putting what you're saying, but it's hard to.
Let's just throw some scenarios out there. Okay. So like from here, I'd see honeysuckle, greenbrier thickets, maybe even cedars, right? Cedars across a lot of the eastern red cedar across a lot of different areas can be like a good place to get shade and or cover. Mm-hmm. Out on like plain states and stuff too. What about like Illinois where we hunted last year?
That was like button brush and some cattails, mm-hmm. and maybe dogwoods, I think, might have been one of the things that were up there. But mm-hmm. it's just kind of like the marsh area of where we were. I don't think there were a ton of deer bedding in the corn then. And then you go to like the northeast. My limited experience there, it seems to be kind of more like the hill-based bedding because those big woods don't have a lot of that thick cover, so mm-hmm. they're using some way to involve seclusion. You go to, like, the grassland-type stuff, a lot of times it's going to be up in, like, plum thickets mm-hmm. is a big one. You see these big old bushes of plums or snowberry or
shelter belts.
Yeah, shelter belts.
For old homesteads.
Old homesteads. There's like this invasive tumbleweed looking stuff that deer love to make tunnels in and bed up in. I think it's just, it ain't as like tricky as people try to make it out to be, but at the same time, it's really hard to find the specific spot. But you can look at stuff and be like, oh, deer bed there. It's just stuff where they feel like they're really good and hidden.
Yeah, and if you're like, a lot of people want to talk about buck beds. It's like a hot, trendy topic over the last few years. But I think you take these like bedding areas and then put them in places that people never go, and that's where bucks generally inhabit if you're looking for buck bedding. But I think like we talk about every time we do a Q&A pretty much, and like we talk about a lot, there's not always like there's I don't know. I don't know what the percentage is, but like probably less than half of the places in the country where you hunt deer have like buck bedding that is like a buck lays down in the exact same spot every day. You know what I mean? It's just, it's kind of particular to like hill country a lot of times, sometimes marsh stuff, right? Because there's only so much dry country. But like, you know, where we're at, not so much. A lot of the plain states, not so much. I mean,
if you had to tell me right now, pick a 5-acre area, you know, there's going to be a buck bedded in, I might have a hard time.
Yeah.
Where we live.
Oh, for sure.
It's just.
Yeah.
It's hard to figure out.
It is. It's random because there's plenty of places they can do it and they know where those are and they just don't. They're just not that habitual. Mm-hmm. They're not quite that habitual to where they bed in the same place every day. They've got places, multiple places. So that's my two cents on it at least.
What saddles do you guys run?
Been wearing a Cruiser XC for a few years.
Yep.
And
super comfy.
I like it a lot.
Yep. There's I've tried on several other different saddles. I'd say, you know, like 2020, we hunted out a tethered Phantom. Is that right? Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
And yep. I had a good year that year, and that was fine. You know, the saddle worked fine. But KC recently got into a tree stand and was like, it certainly is pretty comfortable, you know? So, I mean, the saddle is, we've talked about it. It's undoubtedly, killed more deer for us, but
that's because we did a lot of run and gun public land hunting.
Right.
If you have the ability to pre-hang stands, do it.
Yeah.
That's not the question, though.
No. Yeah, no, we just always expand, you know.
That's right.
Try to give people more than they paid for.
When to call and when not to.
In general, I think that I'm going to call. This is kind of a Bill Winky thing, and I like what he says. It's not always the truth, but I usually do this. Anyways, I'm usually going to call when I see a deer. I'm not, especially when you talk about true calling, because that implies like a mouth noise, right? Antlers rattling, it's still considered calling, but I'm more likely to blind rattle than I am to blind grunt. And I will tell you this, I don't have a lot of takes on when, but I can tell you when not to. And that's when the deer has already decided he wants to go the other direction. I can think of so many times through my hunting life, watching Tyler do stuff and some other people too in the past where the deer's like, I'm going this other way. And then you grunt and he's like, I'm for sure going the other way. And then you snort wheeze and he's like, bye.
I'm never coming back.
That's
here.
That's right. I'm never going to this place ever again.
That is something like to consider though, like how aggressive you get with that calling when you see a deer is, you know, how much do you value your chances next day or two to kill that deer in the same spot, mm-hmm. you know?
I do think that if you're going to be a person who does call, you need to work on your craft and not just dig your grunt call out of your backpack whenever it's like, oh, I should grunt at this deer.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you should be prepared when you go to the woods, like, hey, I might need to bring a deer over here. Let me be ready and think about what that's going to look like when I do that. Because I think the way that deer naturally communicate is they grunt or snort wheeze when they first perceive another deer's presence. So, like, if a deer's in your general area for 2 or 3 minutes feeding around and then you finally grunt at him, I almost feel like he's a little weirder about that than, like, there he is. He's walking by at 90 yards. Let me give him one right now. Bap. And mm-hmm. I think that they are pretty receptive to that.
How do you feel about the new law in Texas that makes hunting riverbeds illegal for archery and rifle?
I submitted some commentary on this the other day.
to a person or a state?
The state.
Mm.
They hate us. so... I don't mean to answer this first, but I can if you want me to.
I mean, would love that.
Okay. I'm going to start out with the perspective of adjacent landowners because I want to be a little empathetic towards that. I own property, and I highly respect private property rights. I think it's very independent and very American. I'm going to appeal to the good Americans out there right now, if you know what I mean. So I understand. And there's two things in this world that make sense to me that good American landowners should understand. And that is people in waterways, and that is people corner crossing. I know Ranella just put out a podcast about the corner crossing stuff in Wyoming. Like, there's like malintent, and then there's just like, just, you know, people trying to do their best with what they have in the world. And I think that you have to look whenever somebody violates something or does something. Are they really trying to hurt somebody? You know, somebody crossing a corner to go from public ground to public ground would much rather that corner not be there and they could just walk freely, right? So they're not trying to cause any problems.
The malintent in the corner crossing issue is that the corners were created
with malintent.
With malintent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's a way to only own half the land but have full access to all of it. Mm-hmm. But back to the river question. I get whenever you're talking about dry riverbeds, it gets a little weird. But there is precedent since before Texas was a state with Spanish land grants that the riverbeds were treated as highways because of commerce. And I get that it's not commerce anymore, but it is traditional use practices, I believe is what Clay Newcomb says. And he's a big fan of traditional use, and I am too. And so from a landowner's perspective, it's weird to have people running around down on the river right by your house. But that's one of the things that if you're going to have property that is adjacent to a public right-of-way, that is the way it goes.
And it's been that way a long time too, so it's not like – probably there's no way that anybody who owns that land hasn't always had it that way.
Yes.
It's always been that way since before they even purchased it, you know.
They just had the right congressman in who would do something to help them out.
I mean, and guess what else? At least this was the way it was a few years back when I was researching this, but easements are that way. Mm-hmm. If there's a traditional use of that easement for so many years – in Texas, then it remains an easement when you, like, if you were to buy a property that has had an easement on it for X amount of years, then it will remain an easement once you purchase it.
Yeah.
So it's very much a grandfathered in thing, which to me would be similar to the easement that's allowed through the high water rule or whatever you would call it.
Yeah.
Water access.
I suppose the question is directly related to the hunting
projectiles.
Yeah. Projectiles where. I get that the bow hunting thing, I think. Even though I don't like it, I get that, like, it's just not a situation that is very conducive to bow hunting if the law is that you can't go recover your game on private property. Some states you can go recover your game on private property, which that's the law, and that sounds good. So I'm going to say I kind of get it. But at the same time, I don't like this argument because it's not very logical, but it essentially is like, how many chips are we going to let them do to this rock before it breaks in half?
Yeah, that's kind of my thing too. It's like, man, I kind of get it, but at the same time, like, it's just the death by a thousand cuts that people talk about where it's like, man, that little paper cut didn't hurt that bad, but then all of a sudden, you know, once they paper cut you there, they're not focusing on paper cutting you on that spot anymore. Yeah. They're focusing on a different spot to paper cut you.
That's right. Well, and you think about this too. They just outlawed rifles and bows. Well, what does that leave?
Shotguns
for ducks. And that's like probably the most common use of a river access. It's the one I've used the most. Mm-hmm. Well, what's the next thing to go off the list? Is that.
Yeah.
So we're losing stuff. And the next time they want to attack something, they're going to attack that. And then after that, it's going to be fishing, and then it's going to be boats completely. So it's just a bad thing.
And the king's going to just own everything.
Guarantee you.
King is in the building, dude.
Gummit.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, man. So, I don't know. It's kind of hard. It's just hard to give up rights that have been traditionally seen as acceptable. But
yeah.
But it is something that you and I have talked about a bunch where, like, I don't know if we ever really definitely haven't just hopped off in a riverbed with a bow and thinking we were going to kill something in that riverbed.
Yeah.
Because that's a good way to have something run somewhere where you can't get it.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is kind of a – isn't it kind of interesting that some states, they would force you to find your game and not have any wanton waste, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they won't force somebody to let you on their property to find that game. It's kind of an interesting concept that, like, the game is of such an important value that they would, like, throw you in jail or fine you heavily for that.
But which one's it going
to
be?
They won't. They don't want to. Yeah. Which, you know, I guess it's cool. We have to put a priority on somebody. I guess if they're doing that for the landowner, private landowner, then it's just interesting to think about. It's something that we might should look deeper into sometime.
It's just a big old conundrum.
It is, man.
I don't know. It's think about this. Does that mean you can't bow fish?
I don't know. I think I saw somebody talking about that at some point on a forum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting.
It's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Is it advisable to pee in a scrape to get a buck going?
Yep.
He's going.
I don't know about getting them going. I don't, you know, anymore. I don't pee in, like, pre-existing scrapes, but I'll make one and pee in it. I did that on my property the other day.
Dude, if I got to pee, I'm peeing in a scrape. It's around. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I guess it's not like I'm looking for it, but I have to pee often. And so if I find a scrape and there's a – you're making a graph and it's like the chances that I'm at a scrape and the chances that I have to pee, they meet often.
X and Y are high on that one. You know, it's an interesting concept that I actually take into consideration. If I have to pee in the woods – and it's anywhere around somewhere I may hunt, I make sure and pee somewhere that's like, if a deer made a scrape there because I peed there, it's not going to put things in a weird predicament. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't want to pee like downwind, you know, downwind of the primary wind of your tree.
I wouldn't say that like if you make a mock scrape and then pee in it, then yes, you could get a buck going, but if it's already a scrape, then there's already pee in it, and there's probably multiple pees in it. And so it's fun to pee in it, mm-hmm. as long as you're not peeing to the camera, the cell camera that sends your buddy pictures, you know, whatever. I don't think it's any more effective to get one going necessarily.
Yeah. I think that is kind of the old thing is people are like, oh, you're really making mad if you pee in there. It's like, I don't know.
I didn't even have coffee this morning or asparagus or anything.
What's a good terrain feature to set up on during the rut?
Terrain feature. I would say one of my favorites is a secondary creek crossing. I like to look for these major creek or river systems and then find these like secondary creeks that come into the river or main creek stem. And there are certain spots that deer cross those areas and therefore it makes for a lot of times a funnel that can't really be seen from an aerial too. Cause you have to actually get in on that secondary creek and walk it to find which trail is the best one a lot of times. And you can use a lot of times it's fairly close to the main creek stem. So you can use the main creek stem to kind of take some of your thermals in a direction that you'd like or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of options around a secondary creek.
To be different than Tyler. I also like that one that he said, I'm going to say a large bend in a river that is a boundary. So, like, a deer can cross about near any body of water it wants to whenever it gets a mind to. But, you know, there's some that they treat as just, like, another thing. And then there's others that they treat as, like, okay, I'm not crossing that until I get chased by a coyote or something. So, if you can find a spot where that thing makes a big old bend, mm-hmm. it's just it's a good pinch. And so, I like that, and also kind of the inverse of that is I don't get to hunt this kind of stuff as often, but I map scout it a lot because I hope to draw Iowa one of these days. But you can also find a river like that that's kind of a boundary, and anytime a ridge kind of like dead ends down into that, it takes all the flat ground and condenses it to like 100 yards. It's another really good spot.
I sent our friend Anthony, he's going to Iowa right now. I sent him one of them creek horns like you talked about that he's going to think be hunting this evening.
No, really?
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yep.
Hope he kills a big one.
Me too, man.
Are mature bucks more likely to breed mature does?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Well, let me – so would you like to get into semantics? Because we can get into semantics about how the question's worded. Mature bucks are more likely to
– yeah, I know exactly where you're going with this.
To win the battle in any scenario. So they're more likely to get to breed a doe on a 1v1 situation, right? So, yes, but they're also more likely to breed younger does too. However, there are some pundits out there that would say that they have data that there's no discrepancy in the amount of breedings from 1.5s up. The same percentages of bucks in every age class do the breeding.
But does that adjust for or account for the fact that there's seven times the number of 1.5s that there is of 5.5s?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it does. And I don't trust any data anymore ever, so it doesn't matter. I take this for what it's worth, but my personal observations mean way more to me than somebody's numbers.
When do you switch from hunting bed to feed to rut funnels?
That's a good question. About November 1. I mean, you know, it's like I've said this, I don't know if I said it on the podcast recently, but I've said it to KC and the guys a couple times because we're talking about schedule and stuff. And I mean, usually there's a property that I hunt some every year. And I'm like, man, every year on trail camera, I get bucks on Halloween, the first or the second that I have not ever seen. And that's when they show up in that 3-day window. And actually Greg was talking about this with me yesterday, I think. And he was saying how a property he hunts also is the same way. It's like year in and year out, those 3 days are like new buck shows up. So I would say that, basically starting at November 1, these two areas are probably 6 hours apart, but, there's a lot of different variants regionally. But I think just like generally speaking for most of the country, especially when you talk about the regular Midwest rut, that's like a good time to start switching the tactics up.
There's a place that I hunt regularly that is bed to feed all day, every day. Not all day, but every day. And the deer just do rut stuff on the way to the feed and on the way back. And it's because food there is very agrarian and about – like solitarily going to be agriculture, you know, like there's not a lot of natural browse. So it's a little dependent on where you're at in the country as well, but you're still, I think you're hunting funnels on that. Cause those deer, they move a lot every day. So it's almost like you're mixing the two things all the time.
Should I hunt the rut?
I remember seeing this one. the answer is yes. The rut is the best.
It is, dude.
Man, alive.
I mean, there's never a chance, a better chance than like the 2-week window around, you know, peak breeding dates that you have. There's never a better chance to shoot like a 200. You know, there's never a better chance to shoot a deer that is not spooky on your trail camera.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, for sure.
And if you don't have a 200 on your trail camera, then you ain't got a chance unless you're in the rut.
Up on August.
You know what I mean?
No, not
really. So, you know, that's my thing is like if you've been sitting there all year and you're, you know, listening to this podcast right now and you're like, man, I got like this 1 8-point. He's all right. You know, I'd shoot him. Hunt the rut because then all of a sudden a 140 is going to show up. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's where you get deer that make big, long expeditions to find does and end up on properties that they only have seen twice in their life or something, you know. So it's definitely worth doing. In fact, one of our buddies shot a deer on public land several years ago that was like Boone and Crockett status, huge deer. And he found out through the grapevine that it had been on a piece of private like 2 miles away its whole life pretty much. and he shoots this thing in the rut on public land because
being a zombie.
Being a zombie, yeah. I mean, same. The Chris B story is pretty similar to that too. No, there's a different one, but I can't really say.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at OReillyAuto.com/meat eater. That's OReillyAuto.com/meat eater. Hey, everybody knows Weber grills. I've been using Weber grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood pellet grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear, what I like to do, on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, which gives you great smoke at 180 degrees, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. This is my way of bold statement. If I was going to cook roast one way, that's how I like to do it, sear roast. Utilize the smoke boost setting to intensify that smoky flavor. Direct flame cooking creates searing, crisping, and browning. Food is going to look as good as it tastes. This grill gets hot in 15 minutes. Cleanup is easy. Cook confidently with intuitive digital controls at the grill and enjoy the sleek, easy-to-use surface. You can also add a heavy-duty rotisserie or rust-resistant griddle insert to up your game. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood pellet grill. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
What is the most important accessory you bring to the woods during the rut?
That's a good question, too. Probably my broadheads. No.
You're allowed a smart aleck answer.
Okay, good. Perfect. Go for your smart aleck.
A water bottle.
Mm.
Might not even be that smart aleck, but Pop-Tart. My wife says she's making homemade Pop-Tarts.
That sounds good.
She has a lot of good intentions, though, so yeah. We'll see. I mean,
the best.
I appreciate her, but she got two little kids at home. I don't know if it's going to happen or not.
Yeah.
My actual would be rattling antlers because I don't think there's a better way to kill a deer that's way far off than with rattling antlers.
This you have to keep an eye on where this is legal, right? But a screw-in step or two.
Mm.
I usually carry two because of these reasons. So there was a place we hunted that was a few hundred acres. We had permission to hunt Kansas a few years back, and we eventually found out that there's just this like center of the property tree that's like pretty short, but it's a hackberry, and like, you know, I'm gonna go in there blind and hunt the middle of this property, so I gotta walk a half mile in on private, right, and then hunt this tree hoping to find some, you know, some where the place that I can shoot a buck because it's pretty open property. And I go in and, you know, pretty immediately find out that I need, and this is something you can get into at any time, but, you know, cottonwood trees can be really big. You can't get sticks around them. It makes a step can make for a good bow hanger if you need one. It can make for a good gear hanger, for a backpack hanger, because they're steps, so they're stout. They'll hold a lot of weight if you have a bunch of stuff in your backpack. A lot of times, like, you may need that thing just to get the bottom step, you know what I mean? Because you just don't have enough rope on your stick or whatever, you know, and it's real handy.
Eric and I were on it together last year trying to hang in a cottonwood tree. And, dude, I think I was, like, doubling up the sticks.
Yeah.
It's like
– Well, I think you took a tethered and tried to extend
it.
Yeah,
I had my saddle rope to try to extend it. I mean, like, it was, like, 18 feet around the tree.
I made some extended ropes one time for those muddy – I think for those muddy sticks.
Those work too.
And they were like 10-foot long ropes. And I cut them – I cut, like, you know, a 40-foot rope or whatever and 30-foot rope into 8 or 10-foot deals or whatever. And so I could add that to, you know, my stick or whatever. And because at the time we were hunting a lot of areas that had these big lone just bull cottonwoods that were just enormous, right?
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, well, I'll figure out how to get into one of these. I can take this rope and I can, you know, do this. So I take it and I remember the one time we tried to put it around a big tree and it just doesn't have enough tension, you know. You can't get enough on it when it has to go around that much surface area and catches on the bark all the way around and try to tighten in the end that, like, the stick would never be tight enough to catch.
It's pretty hard to get it even around the tree.
Yeah.
You know.
You got to have two guys to get around the tree pretty much.
What do you do when you get to the second one?
Hope that the trunks have split or something.
It's almost like you ever been on the bridges crappie fishing and seeing guys with the hula hoop things?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's like what you need to go around a tree.
Yeah.
But
so hula.
Those cottonwoods are a problem.
Yeah.
Like, I love them. They're pretty. They mean good stuff when you're around one.
Dude, a small one.
It's awesome.
Primo.
Yeah, the bark isn't as gnarly on the small ones either.
Yeah.
Like, they're really good to hang in.
You almost have to think that it's tiny. Because if you go to a cottonwood, you're like, oh, that looks like a medium-sized one.
When you get to it. Oh, my God.
You can lay down on
it. Oh, man.
Like, if you cut it off on a stump, you could make a bed out of it.
You could carve a car out of it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, they are huge,
yep,
man.
For sure.
Do you use attractants, and what is your go-to, if so?
I do not.
My camera guy does.
Mad Mike?
Old Spice?
No, you. Eric, he's a Suave conditioner.
Yeah, for sure. Perk Plus.
It's like it attracts mostly male species.
No. Well,
deer, though.
I trust you to play the wind right.
That's right.
Let's go, Eric.
When I hunt with Brian, then that's when I do.
Oh, Brian. Brian. Brian.
Brian. Yeah, I mean, so to not just say no.
Yeah, we need to.
I have used some stuff, and I think that Tink 69 works okay every once in a while. I think that
not
public
sponsored.
Land, yeah. public land deer get real used to that smell. Like, I think it all smells the same to them, you know, so they're like, oh, this is, they kind of know what that is. But I've seen times on private ground where we used to live that deer would, like, get hype about that stuff, so.
I don't know if I've ever used a scent attractant that worked for me.
Yeah.
I cannot think of a time. I haven't used a bunch of them, but I've used some. There was a couple of years when, probably like 17, 18, maybe 19, when you and I would use some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But
we used to use some of that as almost like a cover scent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it works or not, but it make you feel better.
Sure enough.
Mm-hmm. Until you got it on your hands.
then you feel worse for sure. Headache. Yep.
What's the best setup you have that consistently works for mock scrapes?
I'm not sure on the question.
Yeah, it's kind of – so, like, maybe just – I'm just going to answer what the best mock scrape is that we make. There's two of them. One of them is at a place we call Babylon. It's just an elm tree branch that just hangs out and kind of blows around in the wind. But I made a mock scrape there in 2017, maybe even 2016, and there's been a scrape there every year since. Like, I don't have to make the mock scrape anymore. I made it one time, and then it just became like a thing. So that works really good. It's just in a, it's in what we call a DMA.
Mm-hmm.
If you've been listening to The Element for a while, you remember DMAs. We still talk about them. It's a deer movement area. It's a place where a lot of deer hang out and they move through, but you can't really put your finger on the specific pinch or food source or anything. It's just like an area. There's more deer there than there are in the general area. Mm-hmm. So that scrape and that DMA is real good. Another one I just looked at. Tyler, you just sent me a picture of it. Because we were talking about, we're going to do a scrape video. And there's this scrape on the edge of a waterway. And it's just on a trail that's been used by deer since before I was born, probably. And it always picks up deer. It's a good mock scrape. I'm not sure it's a destination. I think it's just more of, it's in a place that deer are going to walk by anyways, so they're going to stop at that scrape and smell around.
It's on a weird tree, too.
Oh, weird, really.
It's got like
tree.
A one limb on the side, and the rest of it doesn't have any limbs, really.
Yeah.
I think if this matters, obviously, if you're going to make a mock scrape, you want to be able to shoot to it. You don't want it to be too far. You'd like for it to be on your weak side when you're looking at, like, think about, like, if you're a right-hander in the batter's box, you want it to be where the pitcher's going to be, right? So you want to be able to shoot, you know, 90 degrees to, from where you're facing off to your left, basically. So left-handed would be the opposite. Apparently, Eric shoots a right-handed bow left-handed. Did you know that?
No, did somebody say that?
Oh, there's a bunch of comments on it, dude, on that doe, story, the world's most famous doe story.
That's weird.
Yeah, there's a bunch of people that are like, why is he shooting right-handed bow left-handed? I don't know. There's some people correcting them. Don't worry.
That's weird.
Any tips on eliminating hip pinch in the saddle?
That's you, bro.
Have small hips.
I knew you were going to say that.
like me. There's a couple things. You can run the longest bridge option that you can. So I see guys just get in the tree in their saddle and don't adjust too much. There's some guys that I know that really tighten down their, like, leg straps, whatever they're called. Those things are meant to be loose, not tight. And then the bridge is the portion that kind of, like, runs across your waist but isn't tight. There's a belt, and then there's a bridge. The bridge is the portion that looks like a triangle whenever you're suspended. And that attaches to your tether, which attaches to the tree. Run your tether really short and your bridge really long, and that'll help with your hip pinch. And then also just having a more comfortable type of saddle. They have different adjustments for that kind of stuff. So
I think the height of the tether matters too. Like if you go too high with it, then it does some weird things. I usually try to keep it eye level.
Yeah, it's kind of how I am too. The first time Tyler and I got in saddles.
Oh, my goodness.
It was, dude – we thought we were hunting. We should have been somebody on the ground filming us just being comical.
Michael thinks it's hilarious.
He
wishes he was there.
Oh, Greg Godfrey.
He thinks he knows better than us.
We had him on the podcast, and he's a nice guy. And he was talking about, you know, hanging in a saddle, what that looks like, yada, yada. And he said he puts his tether, like, as high as he can reach. Well, I don't realize that Greg is shorter in stature than the average guy. And maybe that makes a difference. If I put my tether as high as I can reach, I am like I'm on a swing set.
You swing.
I swung that day. I just whoop right out, just hanging out, dude. I think I fell into you.
Yeah, you blasted
you.
Me, dude.
So, yeah, put that tether around about your eyeballs where your nose hits the tree. Put it short. Make your bridge long. Pretty good setup.
I go with the chin a lot of times.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, you're even taller. I wonder if that makes a difference.
I wonder, too.
Mm-hmm.
Best time of the year to rattle?
It's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like today until the end of November, whatever today is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much, man.
Yeah.
It's like if you listen to this after November, then it's pre-November, but it's also post-November.
I've tried to, like, kind of zero in on this a little bit better, and I think it's kind of hard. Because you want to be like, okay, all the bucks are working it out right now. Once you get to, like, the breeding stage of the month, there's going to be less of that going on. But I don't really think that they are as in tune to that as we are. You know what I mean? They're very instinctual and reactive. Yeah. So
I think there's a little more really to how you rattle at different kind of stages of the rut than there is to, like, is it going to work? You know, I think, like, if it's late October and you go to crashing the antlers together and, you know, breaking tree limbs and stuff, you may spook some stuff. And you may not, but you may spook some stuff. Whereas you could be a little more, I don't know, like, there's a video that may or may not be released by the time this comes out where you almost killed a buck in South Dakota. And there was, like, some, this is early October, and there was kind of still some decent little, you could hear the bucks fighting, you know. I mean, it wasn't like they were raging or anything, but, like, there was a little buck, and the buck you were going to shoot were fighting.
Oh, yeah. You're talking about that just happened.
Yeah.
I was trying to think years back. No, yeah. That and that buck, no. that buck, the bigger buck, came out because two bucks, not just because, but it was brought to his attention quickly that two small bucks were spiking it out over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted to go let them know who the real big boss was around that country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like a full-fledged fight, but it also wasn't like what the spikes were doing when they were out there by themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think, like, you got to just understand, like, if it's October, maybe you've rattled loud enough and aggressive enough to get the attention and curiosity, pique the curiosity of something, but you don't, like, you don't act like it's the knockdown dragout that happens on November 6th. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then on November 6th, you can do that and get away with it maybe. And then in the post rut kind of area, late November, maybe you go back to a little bit more of a timid thing, or maybe that doesn't work and you just go full fledged and all of a sudden it's like, hey, I didn't know anybody was still doing this thing. You know,
speaking of November
6th, you gotta try stuff and learn.
On November 6th, a couple years back, I watched two giant bucks duke it out, almost fight to the death. And that would be a good time to really make them loud.
Mm-hmm.
It's going down. It's most going of the time that time of year.
For sure.
First time hunting Texas public land, is the mornings or evenings best?
Man, it depends on the time of year. This is a rut podcast, so let's assume it's November. I'm going to say, in my personal experience, I have had better morning hunts than I have had evening hunts. But I also tend to be a morning guy. So it could be that I have higher confidence in the mornings because I already feel that way and I make confident decisions that put me in the area of bucks. If I thought about it long and hard, I might change my tune. But I don't know. It's probably marginal at best, if you could say better mornings or better evenings. We've all 300 Texas public, so you answer in a second too.
Yeah, I'm an evening guy, so I like the evenings better, but in the same tune, like, if I think back to hunts, it might be marginal. I can think of, you know, you passing the biggest buck I've ever had a chance at on Texas Public one time. That was a pretty good evening hunt.
Yeah.
And I've killed.
That stand was pretty good on evenings.
It was.
In particular, yeah.
I've killed three bucks on Texas Public, and they've all been in evenings. But I just like evenings better. And so maybe same way. Like, maybe I just – and maybe it's not that – maybe it's not that you like it so you're better at it. Maybe it's you're better at it so you like it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Maybe – whatever you do lends itself to morning hunting better than mine. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you like it, because you tend to – who knows, like, what the variable is that makes you pick the spot that works out better in the mornings and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So you have better hunts in the mornings because you're just better at that. So
yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of weird. Like, I think it's really the answer to the question is more about what are the deer doing that you're hunting, you know?
Well, yeah. Well, I'd say if you're talking about – East Texas river bottoms, the deer a lot of times are spending their nights on private. So that's one of the reasons I like mornings, because they're going to come back to the public to cover in bed, whereas in the evenings, a lot of times you're trying to slip in close to them, which is sketchy. Mm. But that's just a thought. Mm-hmm. I mean, I miss Scar on an evening. Passed that deer on an evening. Seen Pretty Boy a few times on an evening.
He had a rager last year in the morning.
That's right. That's the one I'm thinking about most recent.
Mm-hmm.
Giant buck chasing a doe like a madman in the morning. Eric?
Mm-hmm. Kind of what you're saying. I like mornings more like what Tyler's saying, too, is I don't feel like I'm good at evening hunts or getting close to where they're bedding at. I don't think I'm very good at that. So I see more action in the mornings, it seems.
Yeah. You killed one in the morning last year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Almost killed two bucks.
Yeah.
Then you would have been in real trouble, dude.
I do feel as if deer in the morning are doing different stuff than deer in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like deer in the morning are still in the big mix of everything. So there's like does around, and there's little bucks, big bucks, and they're just kind of messing around. And then the evening, you have a better chance of maybe seeing a lone buck
mm-hmm.
who got up and he's going to like make some ground and try to smell something.
Mm-hmm. There's two scenarios with this question. One's in a thicket and one's in an open area. At what distance or when do you draw your bow?
Man, I change on this a lot.
Say it.
dude,
I'm having like a energy chew crash right now.
Are
sorry,
you?
Dude.
Thank you. Get some of that coffee right there.
Mm.
It also depends in a tree. So let's just – I'm going to assume that his in a thicket versus open area is also kind of a on the ground versus in a tree thing. But that those two are different, so whatever. A lot of times right now I'm using my draw to stop a deer. I think about that a lot. It depends on the deer's attitude. If he kind of already knows I'm there, then it's real sketchy. But if he doesn't, then it's a great way to stop a deer. Because, I mean, he doesn't hear something. He probably has to turn it. Like, if he's looking at you, don't do it. But he has to turn his head to kind of be like, what was that? And it's too late when that happens, for sure. If it's a deer that's walking and he's going to walk down a trail I have a shot at, I'm going to draw pretty early. Just so I can choose when, like, my decision when to stop him with a bat and shoot. Oftentimes, I think in a tree, too, like, as I think about it, like, it's so scenario-dependent.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to get my bow drawn pretty early. I'm a pretty strong guy, so I can hold my bow back for a while. I don't want to hold it back for 2 minutes, but I will. And, you know, holding my bow for 30 seconds doesn't bother me at all. So if a deer's walking to me, he's 60 yards off, and he's on a kind of a slow walk, I'll draw my bow because I'm kind of out of the bubble a little bit and just – when he gets to a spot, I know the exact range or to a real close spot, shoot him.
Mm-hmm. It's very scenario dependent. I think that I'm the same way. Like if a deer is on a walk, I'm drawing pretty early. If the deer is moseying around, smelling stuff, like you can watch the Nameless video and I go half draw like twice. And I realize that the deer, like as soon as I start drawing, the deer stops. And so I let back down real quick because I'm like, I don't want to hold this for whatever, however long that's going to be. It's windy. I'm going to be able to draw. It's not like a big issue. I just want to make sure I draw back, give it a few seconds, and pull the trigger instead of having to hold for, you know, a minute and a half or whatever potentially. So, and then like last year in South Dakota, that deer was on a pretty good consistent walk. So I drew pretty early on that deer. And he was kind of facing me when he came down the edge of that creek. He kind of, once I knew he was just going to be on a straight walk, he's probably like 30 yards and about near eye level. So I really had to wait till he went behind some a thick part of the willows to draw. But then I drew back. Once I got back, I was like, oh, money in the bank. And it wasn't because I didn't make a good shot. And then, like, there's other things to consider, like, if the deer walks behind a big tree, I can think about when I was on the ground in Arkansas, I drew on that deer when he walked behind a big tree. You want to draw as soon as his eyes go behind that tree. Mm-hmm. Like you have to react quick because as soon as his eyes go behind the tree, he's about to pop out on the other side. So you've got to get like all the way back or he's going to catch you when he comes out the other side in the back half of your draw. Mm-hmm. And so, but like, you know, your mind, it works fast. So you can make pretty good decisions on drawing, and I think some people don't work quite as fast or haven't been in the position very often. So it's one of those things you're going to have to, like, another thing you have to live and learn through a little bit. But the one thing that you can do to help yourself out, and this is what we used to do in football a lot, but it's kind of like envision what you expect to happen and why you're set up there. Well, the reason you're set up there is because you have some sort of expectation that something's going to happen. So what is that expectation? Is he going to come from the right, or is he going to come from the left, or is he going to come from straight forward or behind you or whatever? So envision that, and then think about where you're going to draw, and think about the window you're going to shoot him in, right? You want to draw before he gets to that window if it's a small window, right? If it's a big window, not necessarily. Like, you could do like KC said, you could stop him with your draw in the big window. In the small window, it might not be a great idea.
I think Mark Drew would call that a short window, I believe.
Yeah.
Real short window.
Yeah, it is. It's like Karn.
That's right.
You know, you could put some Karn there, actually, right. In that window. And that would help you to get the stop, you know, or whatever. Yeah. But that's, you know, that's another thing. If you can bait or whatever, if you want to bait, it'd be good to pile up. I learned this from this is a Texas deer lease thing right here. I learned this from a guy named Uncle Randy that I don't even know if it was related to me or not. He put a, like, we always had this, like, chum corn concept where you take a bag of Walmart sack about halfway full of corn, and you as Brendan Rhodes would say, you spatter it, you know. Well, Uncle Randy showed me you could just pour that corn right behind a big old prickly pear or log, mesquite log or whatever, and that when that deer came in there, nose down, his eyes are behind it, and you pull it, you know, pull back and then shoot him. So just, you know, thinking
just
about
Uncle
things
Randy
like that.
Of Randyville fame.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a I mean, we could do a whole podcast, and we have before years ago, actually, when you lived in a different town. We did an Art of the Draw podcast.
Spooky.
And you can really talk about all the things, but like you really, more than anything, my best tip is to envision making the play before you get into a situation where you have to make the play.
Yeah.
You know what their tendency is, and envision yourself picking the ball off and take it to the house on that.
Eric, this is going to seem like I'm just telling you things because you recently had a kind of a situation like this, but it's not, not like telling you this, but it is a thing to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Sooner rather than later is also a good thing to think about. Mm-hmm. You should never think that you have all the time in the world.
Right.
Because I can think back to my 2020 Kansas buck. I thought I knew what trail that deer was coming in on, and then I lost sight of him for a while through a thicket, and I was like just zoned in, ready for him to come down this trail, and then all of a sudden I look over, and he's on a different trail. I'm like, oh, crap. And then he does this really weird buck thing where he just takes off sprinting for 12 yards, and it's really, oh, crap, because he almost ran out of my shooting window when he did that. And thankfully, he ran right up there and stopped and looked the other way I drew and shot him, but
so
he could
sick.
Have easily just – ran through, no shot, because I didn't have my bow drawn. Whereas, like, if I, like, saw him and didn't lose him over there, I could have drawn my bow when he's behind a big cottonwood, and he would have been standing there at 22 yards, you know. And so, like, there's this concept of, like, all of this. Envision it, you know, make sure you do it at the right time, but don't just wait around because the deer could just make a 90 – and all of a sudden, all you can see is his booty for the whole time he's there.
Well, and being around a lot of deer and knowing deer fairly well helps you to make those decisions better and better. So
shoot you some does.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And knowing that, like, well, this deer's going to do this. He's not going to take a 90 there. Mm-hmm. Like, having a really good idea that's not going to happen. But like you said, like,
think about Nameless.
Yeah, I know.
You remember right before you shot him, he, like, stuck his head in the weeds and almost bulldozed through there.
Yeah, spooky.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
It was like literally almost just didn't get a shot at that deer.
Yeah.
Because he just did some weird thing. And then he like turned back out and you shot him.
And I mean, yeah, just draw your bow. Yeah, like you said, earlier than later. You don't want to look back and say, oh man, why didn't I draw
all? You can't shoot him with your bow not drawn. I think about you talking about that big deer. We're going really long on this question.
That's a good one.
But that big deer that ran through on me last year on Texas Public in the morning, his doe was like at 4 yards locked up. And I saw him running at us, you know, not at us, but at her. And I went ahead and drew my bow because I was like, look, he's going to run her through here and I'm not going to get a shot if I don't draw. You just got to have your bow drawn. And sometimes deer see you draw your bow, like a different deer or something like that. And that's risky. And in that case, I think it actually hurt me. But in my mind, I was like, I can't shoot him without my bow drawn, you know, so get it back.
And, you know, another thing is if you can't see the deer's eyes, that's a good time to draw. So, like, if you don't think a deer is looking at you, but you can see his eyes and he's at 17 yards, there's a high chance that he's going to see you draw. And if you don't want to get seen drawing, then wait till he turns his head away. You can watch the ranch buck video, actually, and get it. Like, people have asked me I forget, somebody asked me this the other day, like, what were you thinking? Why weren't you drawing here? I just always have wondered why you took so long to draw on this deer. And you can watch him, and he's looking, and I can see his eyes. He's looking at does that are blowing at me because I just stood up in my stand when he jumped the fence. And I just was holding in there just waiting because I knew if I drew, he's on high alert, and I can see his eyes, even though it's the back of his eyes kind of. So when he turns and looks to his left and his head is completely away and his eyes and vision is blocked, that's when I drew. And that's, I mean, if you don't want to stop a deer with your draw, then you can't. I mean, it's going to be hard to draw when you can see their eyes.
Very similar situation to, and this is another great thing to look at, but my 2021 Oklahoma public land deer, the fence buck, if y'all have watched the fence buck, go watch that, but don't watch the shot. I mean, do watch the shot. It's really cool. But the pre-roll of that, Tyler throws it down, and it's like, it's kind of revelatory how deer's eyes work whenever they feed. So this deer's eating tiny little green grasses before he goes to take a drink. And you look at a deer, like you look at your deer on the wall, their eyes are on the side of their head kind of facing forward. When a deer puts its head down to feed, all of a sudden his head morphs and his eyes become on the top of his head. You know what I'm talking about? I'm kind of like making a joke, but like for real, that deer's eyes, when his head's down eating, there's a real good clip. He's still looking out in front of him
when
his head's down. So it ain't like they're looking down at the ground anymore. They can see, like, if you ever put a GoPro 360 on, and that's what they're looking at, you know, like just big old Ren and Stimpy head.
Yeah.
You know? Like that's, and it's weird how much they, and then that deer at the same time is a great example of the whole, oh, he's distracted, draw your bow right now.
Yeah.
That's what it did. That deer, for some reason, he heard another deer behind him, whipped his head around, and I said, oh, this is the time. I draw my bow. He turns and looks at me. He's at 14 yards. It is too late.
Yep. And you're drawing drawing through your peep sight pretty much.
Yes.
Like that's, you know, if you draw through the deer, you're minimizing movement that he sees. You're also coming straight back to your eye and your peep is there. And I mean,
oh, I shot you literally less can than
shoot. Yeah. It's like a second, you know, I mean, it's so fast.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
It is. And that's but that's a good point. Like a deer can literally smell how far that grass is from his lips. He doesn't need to look at it.
That's right.
He's looking at you and other things that are dangerous, like crocodiles in the Amazon.
That's right.
Rainforest.
But they have like a little bit of a one-track mind, right? So he gets distracted by that thing. He's zoned in on it. He's not thinking about what's going on over here because he's like, that's going to eat me over there. And then all of a sudden he's like, that's going to eat me in the tree. To like, pow.
Yep.
Okay. Next question.
If only you shot an adult arrow at that
I know,
deer.
Right?
You would have gotten – oh, wait, you did get two holes.
Shot. I can't believe it. Yeah. Wow, crazy.
All right, this is the last question.
Oh.
When is the rut in Central and Northeast Texas?
Those are different.
If you are
maybe
not from Texas, you don't understand how far apart those places are.
Well, they were two separate questions. I combined them.
Oh. Yeah, okay. But I'm just explaining, like, if you are from Delaware and you haven't been here – those are like 6 hours apart. So Northeast Texas, this also depends on what you call the rut, but let's just say perceived chasing and all that stuff. I'm going to say it is the middle of November. It's a little bit later than the Midwest. And it's like, for instance, I was looking at some historical data right here on the Moultrie mobile app.
Wow.
How about that?
Look at you.
I know. And there's some good daylight buck moving on the 13th of November in 2021. That's a good time. Last year was a little bit later, but anywhere from like 13, 14, 15 through Thanksgiving is a good time to see rut in East Texas.
Yeah. I looked at one point, this has probably been 2 to 3 years, in Northeast Texas, well, just East Texas cameras that we've run were all pretty similar, and I was seeing the most in my just I didn't do any filtering on an app or anything, the Moultrie mobile app or anything. I just did my own research on our cameras because we didn't have a ton of cameras. We had a few. And over like the course of 3 years, November 14th was probably the best day overall for daylight buck movement. Mm. And so you're saying the 13th. I mean, that's within a 24-hour period of each other there. So that's a good one. Now, Central Texas – I don't know. It's been so long since I hunted Central Texas.
Like, Greg's over there. What do you say, Greg? He's off the max. Peak breeding 7th and 8th, he says, peak breeding habits.
So pretty standard, probably.
Around Austin.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, Thanksgiving. And then you go a little bit further south, which would be considered South Texas, you're looking at December ruts.
I mean, so if you're hunting from the 5th to Thanksgiving – it's a pretty good window for most of probably Central Texas. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Yep.
That's all of them.
Good questions. All right. We'll do another one of these things soon. We appreciate y'all listening. Go check out the Element YouTube channel if you haven't. Eric shoots a bunch of big does. Tyler shoots a big old buck. Then by the time you're listening, there might be a new video out. I don't even remember which one's coming out next.
Chris Webb.
C-Dub and Eric on the quest for big bucks in South Dakota.
Questivities.
Ah, I love it. Man, we appreciate y'all. Sorry, today was kind of we talked a long time about some things, but man, I feel like ready to hunt deer already.
I'm
talking through this stuff gets me like hype and like practiced up. Almost.
I feel like I should go out there right now.
I've been checking the camera to make sure you don't need to.
Oh, well, I don't, but I would like to. It's just not quite there, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm going to just sit here and edit videos so that y'all can watch when I have hunted and when other people have hunted in this group. So,
yeah. Well, guys, remember, November is awesome. And remember,
este es su elemento. Vivelo.
Hey, everybody knows Weber grills. I've been using Weber grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood pellet grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood pellet grill. You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.